Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are about to listen to the story of Bruce Henderson, Managing Director for Jaguar and Land Rover for the Middle East North African region. He's been in the role since April 2014, and Bruce joins the Meta team with 19 years of experience in global sales and operational roles for Jaguar, Land Rover, and key markets such as China, the United Kingdom, South Africa. He's a man who's worked on many continents, and he was formerly the Executive Vice President of Sales and Service for Operations for Jaguar Land Rover in China, which is now the largest market for both Jaguar and Land Rover products globally. I don't think anyone would be surprised by that stat. He's been there for 3.5 years, and he'll be giving us some insight into the Asian markets. And he was also instrumental in transforming the business from an operation selling less than 20,000 vehicles a year with 34 dealers in 2010 to selling 103,000 vehicles with 220 dealers by 2013. From 2002 to 2010, Bruce held a number of sales and operational roles at Land Rover UK, the largest market for Land Rover sales globally at that time, only now to be trumped by the Chinese, helping to steer the dealer network through the toughest financial recession ever to achieve record levels of profitability in his role as sales director. As Managing Director for Jaguar Land Rover Middle East North Africa, Bruce will spearhead the next phase of growth in what is now one of the fastest growing regions in the world for this luxury automotive manufacturer. Well, Craig, welcome to Eye on Careers, and thank you so much for coming out and joining us on this episode.
Great, Shane. Good to be here, yeah. Thank you.
It's quite exciting. You're almost kind of like an adventurer of the automobile market, going from country to country, taking up challenge after challenge.
Yeah, this is the fourth market. You know, having gone from South Africa to the UK to China to the Middle East, it's been a fantastic career, and it's been a wonderful opportunity.
One of the things with your brand, in fact, is that's your part of your brand story, that it's an adventure. You know, the Range Rover is synonymous with these treks and going from across the Arctic or through the jungle or wherever you want to go. You take your Land Rover.
Yeah, you know, most of the people, the sheikhs in the Middle East, we've been here for a number of years, and it's really, really been good. You know, we've been an integral part of the society. We've been an integral part of many many countries in Africa, many countries around the world, and we've watched these countries develop. We've grown with these countries as a brand, and we'd like to think that for many people, it's the first car that they saw, and hopefully they continue to see our vehicles around the world.
So you were born and raised in South Africa?
Yes, that's correct.
And did you do your MBA before joining the automotive industry, or did you do that, I'm going to work for 5 years and then join it, or how did that pan out for you?
It was a function. I finished my undergraduate degree in South Africa, and then obviously started working for the organization. Moved across to the UK and then decided actually to broaden my horizons. You know, I'd look to study my MBA at Warwick University in the UK, and I ended up doing that. So 3 years. Good part of learning, you know, you always get the opportunity to put some theory and some practice into action, and a good experience. So, yeah, good.
So you've been working with Jaguar Land Rover since the beginning? First job?
No, it was job number two. I was with General Motors to start with.
Oh, you were with a competitor.
I was indeed.
The Americans.
Yeah.
I think they changed the name to Government Motors in the recession.
Not for me to call it
back. I think now they changed it. They changed it back maybe. But that's another story, what's happening over there in Detroit. But so you started with General Motors where, in South Africa?
Yeah, in South Africa. It was a company called Delta Motor Corporation. Saw an opportunity. You know, I guess boys and toys is a word or a phrase that springs to mind. And coming out of school, having gone to university, I wanted to get into the car industry, and was fortunate enough to be able to step into the gap and take the opportunity and build a career.
So what do you think, you know, because you've been able to navigate your way through a very large corporation. I mean, these are some of the biggest companies in the world.
Yep.
What are some of the skill sets you need to navigate the snakes and ladders of a large corporate entity like that?
I think you've got to be humble in your approach. You've got to be prepared to learn. You have to be prepared to listen. You also have to accept the fact that, these organizations are big global organizations. There's always cultural viewpoints that you have to take into consideration. You need to be prepared to work hard. There's no doubting that. But at the same time, making sure you get the balance in life right, because no one just wants a purely academic person or a person that works 24 hours a day for the company. They want a person that's able to, relate to other individuals in the office, relate to what they're doing on a daily basis, and be able to talk about other things, as opposed to just selling cars or working in a financial environment, facts and figures.
But, I mean, by nature, the car industry is a social type of industry, right? I mean, I think, and you look at some of the brands like Jeep or Harley Davidson that actually center their brands around, not just buying a vehicle, but actually buying membership to this social group, in a sense. So, I mean, having that, you always expect people in the automotive industry to have a bit more of a dynamic personality than, maybe you would look at, say, if you look at the big four accounting firms, for example.
I think passion's critical. You've got to be passionate about what you're doing in the motor industry. And, within the motor industry, and it's a great place for a career, you have the opportunity to look at everything. You can look at finance. You can look at marketing. You can look at sales, service. So there's a real dynamism within the industry that allows you to develop. At the same time, people want to be associated with successful brands. They want to be seen to be doing things. And it's how you market yourselves to customers and also to your employees within the business. People within the business have to be passionate about what they're doing.
Well, you use an interesting choice of words. They're how you market yourself. And, one of the things that I always preach is, you are a brand.
Agree.
People don't like to think of themselves as a commodity, but talent is a commodity to a certain extent. How are you packaging yourself? How are you branding yourself? How are you dressing? How are you walking? How are you talking? What's your brand statement? I mean, do you feel that these are all important elements that someone needs to align in order to be successful in the corporate environment?
You've got to know what you want. You listen to people and people say, my career fell into place. I don't believe in that. I believe you drive your career. You go where you want to go. You set yourself a vision. You need to determine what your brand identity is about, what your philosophies are, your management philosophies. Are you a person who operates with a high level of integrity? Are you a realist? Those are the sorts of things that you really need to be looking at to drive yourself forward within any working environment.
And it's one of the areas, I think a lot of people neglect, right? They don't take as much time into, how you're dressing. On one hand, you may have people who I think dress a little bit too relaxed, let's say. And on the other hand, you may have people who think they're going to a fashion show. And, I always say, you're putting a uniform on. Construction worker wears his coveralls and he has this. The police officer has his uniform. The businessman, in my opinion, correct me if I, this is just my opinion. It should be dark blue suit, dark gray suit, white shirt or light blue shirt, depending on your, what you want, a blue tie or a red tie. This is really, if you look at the top business leaders in the world, that's what they're wearing. Now, you want to stray from that, then that's your brand positioning. A marketing guy may purposely stray from it, or a musician might purposely stray from it. You'll very rarely find a Fortune 100 CEO straying from that formula.
No, I agree with you. First impressions are lasting impressions, and that's just true of life generally. I don't think it's necessary to try and stand out from the crowd by walking into the office with red socks and blue shoes.
Some people do it.
Some people do it, but does it really enhance their career and further what they're trying to do at the office? Some people might say, yes, it does. I don't think so. It makes you look like a bit of a joker with a sense of humor, which isn't necessarily what you're trying to portray. But as I say, that first impression is really important, and the way you conduct yourself.
I had one CEO come into an interview, and he was wearing, Western slacks and shoes. He was a European gentleman. And he was wearing a traditional Japanese top dress, like what their formal Japanese style with the buttons down the middle and everything and the priest collar thing going on with the... And, you know, it definitely grabs your attention. And that was his branding. You know, he's like, I'm an out-of-the-box, dynamic, global executive, you know, with a penchant for the East. And, you know, that's what he wanted to go with. But that was a really extreme case. I think you're really rolling the dice and taking a gamble when you break from the norms that far.
You've got to also be confident to be able to do that. You know, you can succeed in an organization. Big organizations welcome a level of entrepreneurship. Individuals are allowed to think. You know, far too often, I think we look at organizations and they say, you come to work in a blue suit, you don't have an ability, you tick the boxes and you leave, you work 8 to 5 and you leave. That's definitely not the case. You know, if I'm looking to employ people, if I'm looking to work with people, I'm looking for people who can do the job, but who have entrepreneurial flair, you know, prepared to get on, get their hands dirty, roll up their sleeves. That's what execs are looking for.
Right, right. And you also have to realize, though, you know, that the ultimate expression of the brand are the senior executives.
Agreed.
So when you walk into a meeting, you're the ultimate marketing statement for the company. And if you're running around in a Japanese suit, you know, this guy didn't get the job. I can tell you that, right? Because, you know, do you really want to show up to a meeting with this guy?
It's about credibility, isn't it? You know, at the end of the day, you've got to be credible in the position and the things that you do and the way that you present yourself and your organization. When people are spending money, they want to be dealing with professional people.
Professional and professional brand. So branding is definitely an important part of it. What about visibility? You know, for example, if I don't know you, I don't know what your capabilities are, I can't lobby to have you on my team, I can't promote you, I can't give you a raise.
I think there's an issue about visibility, but also about capability. You know, visibility is important within an organization. It's important you get to know the people. I don't for one moment support the idea of being a heavy political individual who tries to progress their career by that, because you aren't going to progress it. People see through politicians relatively quickly in an organization. If you knuckle down, you do the work that you're tasked to do, that you set out to do, that you want to do, you get noticed by doing that.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's, you know, I agree with you. I don't think, you know, if you're purely a political animal, I think people will sniff that out fairly quickly. But I think when you look at these large multinational organizations like the ones that you've chosen to plant the roots of your career in, people often who work in these large multinationals act as if they're working in a local boutique. And what I mean by that is when they're working on a project, they're not leveraging the vast network that the multinational affords them. And then other individuals who are hugely successful will say, okay, we're bringing this product to market. Let me call the guy in Latin America, or the guy in California, or the guy in France, or the guy, and who was the most successful at launching this product? And what kind of institutional memory do we have about this kind of a business case, and what's the best learnings from those that I can implement now? Very few people do that. And I think, one, you know, when you think globally, you create by default some visibility for yourself, and by default you're also growing your capability, and you definitely will deliver a better result.
Well, it's about thinking globally and acting locally. You know, the old classic MBA sort of study: think global, act local. By learning from others, by empowering people, you know, that is one way of driving the business forward. But more importantly, you know, it's about the experiences that one gains, the experiences that you have on the team. And as a senior manager within a business, what are you looking for? I'm not looking to get into the detail of every bit of the operation. What I'm looking for is people who are capable of doing that and letting them do their job. Because by doing that, you allow people to develop their careers and also build their level of credibility.
As you've developed your career, did you seek out other top performers across the global network, touch base with them, and create a knowledge-sharing environment? Or was it more just organic through the institutionalized global meetings that the organization has?
No, I think it's a bit of both. You know, you have to perform at the end of the day. Business is about performance. But more importantly, it's about building those alliances, learning from what other people have done and the mistakes that others have made, you know, taking that learning and building it into the organization. So it's about performing your job, but more importantly, about building relationships. You know, there's a lot that happens within a corporate and happens with partners, business partners, that just by having a good relationship, you can get so much more out of people. You just have to look at successful sporting teams. You know, sometimes the success of the team is far greater than the sum of the individuals within it.
That's the magic of the human spirit.
It is.
Well, this is a story of Bruce Robertson, managing director for Jaguar Land Rover in the Middle East in North Africa, giving you his tips for driving success in a large corporate environment, driving your career, and taking the next step in that career path. More with Bruce in just a minute.
Dubai I-103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are talking to Bruce Robertson, the managing director for Jaguar Land Rover in the Middle East, North Africa. He is a bit of a legend in the business as he took the China market from 20,000 vehicles a year and with 34 dealers, and 3 years later to be selling 103,000 vehicles with 220 dealerships. He also championed the brand in the UK through the financial crisis, taking it from a losing position and back into profitability, which are quite interesting experiences, which we will be touching on. Bruce, welcome back to Eye on Careers. I think what we were just talking about is, you know, how to utilize a global network to drive peak performance in your own career, and how, you know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. You know, whenever you're dealing with a problem, you can actually reach out to a global network, especially if you're in a multinational.
Agreed.
But what I think is, you know, even if you're not in a multinational, you can use, you know, through social media, through various sites, you know, you can find out who the top performers are. You can call them. You can ask them, hey, you know, I'm selling blue widgets in Saudi Arabia. I know that you're the number one widget seller in France. What are the three things you would suggest and when launching into a, you know, in a greenfield, and see what they say?
Agreed. You know, with the advent of things like LinkedIn, just email, internet, etc., communication becomes very, very important. And as we were just discussing there, you know, you don't have to be reading the whole time. You can be communicating with people and learning from them. And sometimes what you get from people in a much shorter space is a far more level of intense learning that you can take away. You can implement within the organization. You can see that it works or it doesn't work, and you can feed back to people. By feeding back, you create that network, you create a level of trust, and suddenly your network starts to grow. You start to talk to people, you're introduced to other people. It's critical in terms of the way we do business. You know, and that's across competitive environments as well. You know, the person selling cars at company A may be doing something slightly different at company B, but they learn from one another, they pick up, and at the end of the day, you've got to make sure that you're satisfying your customer. You know, driving that level of customer satisfaction, and you are continually learning. It's no different in management. You're continually learning. You will make mistakes. You know, just don't make the same mistake twice.
How important is it to make a list of top performers in your industry and to keep an eye, you know, not both eyes, but maybe one eye, on what it is they are doing to drive peak performance in their careers and in their teams?
I think you need to be aware of what other people are doing. You know, it would be naive to sit in a room and think that you're doing everything correctly, because that is not the case. People lead, suddenly, I use an example in our industry, people try and sell cars from the internet. Whoop, someone's gone down that route. It hasn't necessarily worked, or they've had to change an element of it to make it work. You know, so you've got to be continually learning, keeping in contact. I don't think it's about making lists. It's about understanding what works for your brand and taking a bit and effectively transforming your business through the learnings of others.
You now we're in China, one of the more exciting regions, and I think maybe the buzz on China may be deflating slightly now as we head into the next chapter of this global narrative that's unraveling before us. But maybe you could shed some light on what the China experience was like. Also, you know, do you suggest for, you know, other professionals, should they look at taking an Asian experience into account as they develop themselves? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to have moved around the world, and I think once you've moved around the world, you begin to realize that there are many different cultures within the span of operation that you have. And it's working in those cultures and adapting to them that allows you to grow as an individual. the China experience was quite something. You know, having moved from South Africa to the UK, having done nearly 9 years in the UK, and then moving out to China, you're going from this hugely Western, relatively conservative business environment to the East, which was just exploding at the time. You know, people throwing caution to the wind, taking high risks, getting really high levels of return. And at the end of the day, it's about making sure that you have a long-term business plan in place, one that is going to be able to survive the ups and the downs. And it's making sure that the people who are investing in those businesses understand that there's going to be good and there's going to be bad. Because at the moment in China, the growth has been so great that people are only seeing the good. And you need to be able to get the message through that guys, it isn't always going to be that way. And I think to the point you made earlier, we are definitely starting to see a little bit of slowing down in certain industries in the Far East.
But isn't it impossible, though? Because I think, you know, when you look at the urbanization rate, the same amount of the whole population of Canada is moving to the cities every year in China. Correct. I mean, it's like over 30 million people.
Yeah.
So how can you have a slowdown when you have, you know, that kind of people moving into urbanize?
You just have to listen to the statistics and figures to the point you make. The Chinese, the country will urbanize in the next 5 years 350 million people.
Oh, my God. That's crazy. That's the United States of America.
Exactly. Insane. Coming into the cities. So you're getting America into an environment where they are moving into the cities. You won't necessarily have the same rate of growth. You may have a slower rate of growth. It will continue to grow. There's no doubting that. It may not grow at the speed that it's been growing at, though.
What's also interesting, though, is the rate of diabetes and heart disease is directly related to the urbanization rate. And so as you start to urbanize, they're also set to double the amount of diabetics that they have in the country.
I can only say from what I saw from personal experience, you know, the way things changed in the 4 years that I was in China was phenomenal. From having, I shouldn't mention brand names, but having a coffee shop on the corner, you know, we all know what we're talking about, to having seven coffee shops by the time we left within 100-meter radius of our building is an indication.
Sounds like Canada.
Same sort of thing.
But they're all Tim Hortons, though. You'll have like Tim Hortons on the other side, so you have another Tim Hortons, you know.
And that's what was happening. So you can see the dietary changes. You can see the impact it's having on the society. You know, the way people are living, the breakdown in some respects of the society from this highly rigid, family-orientated model to a more Western-type, open-minded approach. And it's definitely having an impact.
Capitalism gone gangbusters.
I would call it communism and capitalism combined. You get capinism.
Capinism. So your take that the Chinese market is going to continue to grow exponentially?
Yeah, I think it will continue to grow. There's no doubting that. I think what you will see in the Chinese market is you definitely won't see the high level of business return that one has necessarily achieved in the past 4 or 5 years. I think it will return to a level of normality, but you will see growth. It has to continue to grow.
So was it basically, you know, just managing the growth, making sure that you had the right controls and mitigated your risk exposure when you're in that kind of a growth environment? Or what are the key things that the business leader really needs to keep their eye on?
Well, I think within that Chinese environment, everything, you are looking at minimizing your risk, your exposure, whilst optimizing or trying to maximize the returns for your business. Also protecting your business partners, you know, protecting your employees from this rapid growth and people not knowing how to deal with it and what to do, actually helping them develop as individuals, helping them make decisions, you know, that maybe they hadn't thought about doing before. The educational system within that environment doesn't necessarily support open-minded thinking, you know, and it was trying to get the teams to grow, to think out of the box and actually be able to say to individuals, you have the permission to do it, make a mistake. Because within the society, it's very rigid and failure for many of them is something which doesn't bode well and it doesn't sit well with them. But actually allowing your team to make a mistake and learn from that mistake, you know, I think is one of the key things a good manager should always be doing.
I read that, you know, to punish failure is the fastest road to mediocrity for your organization.
I agree, 100%.
And so you see failure as the stepping stone to success, the shadow of success, one of the foundation stones. Was that a bit too dramatic?
No, I think
it was dramatic.
I think it's a bit dramatic.
It was good, though.
I think everyone's entitled to make a mistake. You just don't make the same mistake twice.
Terminated. You're fired. No. Is that what you did to them? You're like, guys, go ahead and make a mistake. That's two. You're out.
No, we'd never do
Wait,
that.
You're out.
You've got to work with people.
You go ahead and make your mistake. What happens after two? Because no one could see your eyes, though. There was a certain, how you said that second one. It's not tolerated.
You can't have mediocrity in an organization when you're trying to drive it forward. You need motivated people. You need people who are prepared to take risks, but also prepared to, you know, learn from their mistakes. And learning from their mistakes might mean them failing at one particular task. It doesn't mean that they're a failure.
So encouraging failure to a point.
I wouldn't say encouraging failure. Ensuring people learn from a mistake as opposed to planning to fail, because planning to fail is a disaster.
Well, some of the biggest successes are failures. Like penicillin was a total mistake. I mean, the guy screwed up. He messed up the Petri dish. I mean, how bad could you be? I mean, he was so bad, he was good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, but I think if anyone's out there as well in your career, if you're getting fired or you've experienced some failure, it's completely natural. You won't find one person who's full of greatness who hasn't been speckled by failure.
No, and I think, you know, from a career point of view, no one likes to fail. You will always have disappointments. I've had personal disappointments in the career space, but in terms of growing your career, it's how you deal with those disappointments, you know, making sure that you bounce back, because a lot of the time the organization will look at you as an individual as to the way you respond to a setback, because by growing, by working around, by understanding what caused that failure, you grow as an individual, and people are far more tolerant once they've accepted the fact that actually that was a setback for that individual. They've continued to perform at the level they have, and they continue to do very well. We should look at them for potential promotion.
Well, you mentioned you've had some disappointments. What's been the single biggest disappointing or darkest moment of your career path? Was there ever a moment where you just wanted to crawl under a rock and die?
I don't think there's been that moment where you crawl under a rock. I think whenever you're looking for a relatively big promotion and you're going for the interviews and you're going through the process, you always have the belief that you can get that job. And there are some times where you walk out of an interview and you feel that I nailed that interview. That's fantastic. Only to be told someone else did it better. And that takes a lot.
And then you hate the person who got the job.
No, you can't hate them because you've got to work with them.
I know, but you can't say that because you're on the radio. But that's one of the things, actually, from an executive search perspective, when we're placing senior people into companies, is to also that individual has to know when they come in, especially if they're an outsider and they're being brought in, you know, 3-4 senior guys are being superseded for that role, there will be a few knives out for you. You have to manage that political environment. And generally what we see statistically is a 20% turnover. So when you appoint a new CEO in an organization, 20% of the senior leaders are going to leave, some of them for different reasons, because the culture is changing, strategies changing, visions changing, but also one or two of those guys will leave because they were superseded. And you saw that when Jack Welch left GE and they picked a new CEO, all the other VPs were gone and they all became CEOs somewhere else.
And I think sometimes that's because, one, they just feel that they're not going to fit in with the culture. But two, they also see the fact that the writing's on the wall. They aren't going to be the number one. And, you know, people in organizations, when they're at senior levels in big organizations, whether we like to admit it or not, a lot of people have big egos, you know, and it's managing those egos. And for them, actually taking a CEO role in a different company might be a better option.
This is a story of Bruce Robertson, Managing Director at Jaguar Land Rover for the Middle East, North Africa. He'll be giving his tips and lessons learned on the road to the top in just a minute.
Dubai Eye 103.8. keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're listening to the story of Bruce Robertson, Managing Director of Jaguar Land Rover Middle East North Africa. Bruce, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thanks, Shane.
So for those of you just joining us, Bruce has had two jobs. He worked for General Motors and then Jaguar Land Rover, and he's worked in South Africa. He's worked with them in United Kingdom. He's worked with them in China, and I think maybe one or two other geographies. I think those are the main three, though. And he talked about what are some of the key things, or where does your focus need to be successful in a large corporate environment. He talked about the need that you have to work hard. You have to be driving the results. You have to have cultural agility. You have to have the interpersonal skills to mix with people. You need to be passionate about the brand and the industry. You really need to understand marketing, sales, operations. You have to be interested or an intellectual curiosity about how the business works, unwavering integrity, and capability. You know, you have to have strong capabilities. You need to think globally, act locally, build relationships, and interesting as well, embrace failure. Don't be afraid to fail. A lot of people in a big organization will be looking at how you respond to setbacks. But you know, having worked in so many places, Bruce, do people buy Land Rovers or Jaguars differently in China than they do in the UK, than they do in the Middle East?
No, you know, at the end of the day, we sell a premium luxury product. Our consumers are very intelligent people, whether they're Chinese, whether they're American, whether they're English, whether they're South African, Australian. We operate in a global marketplace, and it's no different for our competitors. So the buying patterns are not dissimilar in terms of the way that people go about it. Some of the cultural differences might make a different route to market for product. So in other words, in the UK, there might be a strong lease-based system where you have a high level of vehicle financing. In China, there's more cash-based, although that is changing.
Is that because of the tax?
Well,
it's the tax man's fault.
It's tax. It's the taxes that are implemented. It's the efficiencies, et cetera, that you can get through some of the banks that you work with. The bottom line is, within all the markets that I've worked and the partners that I've worked with and the businesses that I've worked with, people are there to make money. You know, and as long as they're making money and providing a good level of service, generally you will find that operations around the world are not dissimilar in terms of the way they bring cars to market and the way that they do things. What is different is the cultural anomalies that we see. The way the society works is very different in the East, in the Middle East, in the UK, and even in the US. So you have these global products being brought to market in much the same way. A dealership in the Middle East looks very similar to a dealership in the US, to the UK, to China, but the way that it's being brought to the customer at the end of the day might be slightly different.
So what are some of the differences in how you bring it to market in China versus...
If I look at the Chinese market, there's a strong orientation towards the family. So a lot of the marketing materials will be orientated towards that. Sophistication is key in those sorts of markets. So your marketing, your below the line, above the line advertising, etc., is orientated towards a level of sophistication. In the UK, selling vehicles is more a finance orientated environment. So the payment per month is critical. Not dissimilar in places like South Africa. You're looking at that. So there
what about the Middle East? What do they want? Performance? Because I know they like to drive their Land Rovers on two wheels. You've seen that on YouTube. It's amazing. I didn't even think that was possible till you came to the Middle East.
I have seen that. Performance is key here. You know, the 5-litre engine we run here is definitely not going to be the engine we run in the UK, because it's a different psyche, a different mentality. There is a far greater bias towards cash buying in the Middle East than there is in the UK. But at the end of the day, people buying cars, they're buying into lifestyle and experience.
When I first came here, I literally thought that the road from Dubai to Abu Dhabi was an autobahn. I didn't think there was an actual speed limit that was enforced besides the flashers. And then I realized that they actually take your car away. if you go. But it's just that so many people, I don't know why, they love their performance. There's always, like, in the middle of the night, you always hear somebody flying at the speed of sound down the road, and you're like, how fast is that guy going? Like, you know, it's insane.
I think we need to be mindful of road safety and all those sorts of things, and performance cars are one thing, and obviously what people are looking for in the Middle East is very different in many respects to others. But, you know, I think key for us is, at the end of the day, the consumer is spending a lot of money on most probably the second biggest purchase that they will ever have if they've bought a house. They want a good experience. They want to feel part of a brand, you know. And
your car is worth more than some houses.
Yes.
But what's up with this? Commodity prices are dropping. The gas price is dropping, which we don't really want to talk about. But your brand, Mr. Land Rover, has gone up by, like, I don't know, like 20% or something. Increased your prices, didn't you?
No, we haven't. We haven't done that. In some markets, we've actually taken.
No, but in this market. In the Middle East, your price jumped. It was the cheap, you know, it was like a 50,000 dirham increase. The minimum, the cheapest, the least expensive Land Rover was like 350. Now it's like 400, and your top end is like 750 now or something.
So, obviously, we brought a whole lot of new products to market in the last 2 years. You know, if we look at the Land Rover side of the business and Range Rover, we bought the new Range Rover with a whole lot of new technology, both the Range Rover and the Range Rover Sport. And we've just last week actually unveiled the new Discovery Sport, which is a great product. You know, it'll be good for the market. Obviously, the investment in technology, new engine plants, etc., does drive a level of price increase, definitely.
But it's demand, isn't it? You guys are like just selling out.
Yeah,
demand. I mean, you're sold out, right?
We've done very well in the Middle East. You know, we do have waiting lists on the cars. I'm not going to hide behind that. But we're very proud of that.
Isn't that the worst thing, though? Isn't that the worst thing you can do for your business, is to have a waiting list? Because I want a car. I go in. You say, Shane, you can't have your Range Rover for 6 months. I'm going to go buy something else.
Potentially, like, but you also can create demand and you can create aspiration for the product.
Is that what you're going for?
People are trying
to make us desperate.
No, we're not trying to make you desperate. We're desperate to sell you a car. our plants are working 24/7 at the moment to supply the global demand on Jaguar and Land Rover product. So it's a good news story from us, a real turnaround, you know, from the recession in 2008, where things were really tough and we were laying off people. And, you know, we were talking just before the show, and what are some of the toughest things that you've had to do? And that was one of them, you know, going into work in 2008, having to drop sales forecasts significantly, lay people off, affect their livelihoods. But
that was your biggest challenge professionally, was managing the crisis in the United Kingdom, where it was probably one of the worst environments. You were in London, were you?
Yeah, well, we based just outside London, near Birmingham, and it was a tough time. You know, it was a tough time for the industry. It was a tough time for everyone. But having to go in and look at people and say, actually, you don't have a job, we're having to lay you off, and knowing full well that they have families to support and school fees to pay, that's tough.
And what about the stress? Because, you know, you're an inventory-based business, and so that stock is stuck on the yard, and then you have more stock coming because you can't just turn your manufacturing plants off.
We turned our manufacturing plants off, but the stock's on the water. It does create a tremendous amount of financial stress for the dealers. It creates a lot of financial stress for the banks, because at the end of the day, many of the dealers are the banks. So, it was tough, and we had to sell those cars. And we had to take some drastic actions in some of our markets to ensure, you know, that we were able to keep the doors open for many of our partners.
Does that take a toll on your personal health, you know, as a leader, under that kind of responsibility, that type of accountability, that kind of pressure? Does that take a toll on your health?
I think any leader needs to get the balance right. You know, you need to be fit, you need to be healthy. It does have an impact, but if you've got a strong and supportive family, which I do have, it definitely makes a difference. You have to be objective. Sometimes it's difficult not to be emotional about it, but you've a job to do, and you've got to be firm and fair in terms of your approach. Yes, it does take a toll, but I'm still here today.
Did you gain a few pounds, or what happened?
No, I didn't lose any hair. I spent more time on running machines.
Did you? So it's really critical to get the exercise in.
Yeah,
or you can't last.
Fit body, fit mind. It also allows you, I believe, you know, you don't have to go running. You just have to have another vice with which to allow your mind to be cleared. you know, because you can have this tendency in a crisis within an office environment to go in at 7:30 in the morning, leave at 7:30 in the evening, go home, tell your family all the problems, get out of bed the next morning and go straight back into it. You need to be able to break that cycle, be positive about something or look forward to something. So even in tough times, treat yourself.
So you work out in the evening or the morning?
Both.
Both? Yeah. Two times?
Well, not necessarily two times every day, but yeah.
Obsessive.
Yeah. I wouldn't say obsessive. I enjoy fit body, fit mind.
Okay, because, you know, I think that in the evening, especially as a senior executive, there's always dinners, there's always events, there's this, that, you're getting pulled here, there. You know, you're not in control of your evening time. Isn't the morning the one time you have a chance to work out? But other executives are like, that's the one time I can do my reading, I can do my clear thinking, it's quiet, and I can you get my strategic, critical thinking out of the way.
Look, it's each person to their own. I absolutely believe in getting the balance right, and I push this with my teams. You know, I don't want unhappy people at the office, because unhappy people at the office lead to unhappy families, you know, and that for me is not good. I would rather have a good working environment where my teams are happy. You know, I don't generally like to do meetings after 5 o'clock in the evening, because I like to set the example for the team. We can get the work done during the day. There's obviously occasions where you know we need to be doing that. You have the functions in the evenings, but it's about managing your time and setting the priorities. And health is a priority.
This is Bruce Robertson, Managing Director of Jaguar Land Rover for the Middle East, North Africa, sharing his secrets and lessons learned on the road to the top. Be sharing a bit more of what he looks for when he's hiring people and his advice for anyone who wants to be in the top 5% of their profession. So stay with us.
Dubai i 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. We're here with Bruce Robertson, Managing Director, Jaguar Land Rover, Middle East, North Africa. Bruce, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Good. Great.
Great. So, you know, what do you look for when you're hiring someone? What do you see as the traits that step out where you say, this guy, he's my winning horse, or this lady? I mean, maybe we shouldn't refer to a woman as a horse, but, you know, you know, a top performer, she's going to do great. This guy's going to do great. What do you look for?
I think I look for a number of philosophies. You know, first of all, generally, you'll be able to gauge someone relatively quickly in terms of their knowledge, what they want, and then their level of realism. You know, there's nothing more annoying than interviewing someone and he says, I want to be the managing director. You know, you're not going to be the managing director tomorrow, but you'd be surprised how many people say, oh, I can get there in 2 to 3 years when they have no experience.
In 3 years?
Yeah.
The managing director.
And there's no credibility then. You know, that's exactly the point. I've done a number of these business school career fairs where you go there and you say to people, you know, they come up to your stand and they want to talk about your company, and the first question you ask them is, what do they want to do? And they say, I want to do strategy, or I want to do finance. And you say, well, you know nothing about the company, you know nothing about the industry, why do you want to do strategy? I want to do strategy. You know, that's not what you're looking for. You're looking for people with levels of integrity, people who are prepared to work hard, get their heads down, who don't know everything. You know, we learn every single day we go to the office. I'm still learning, and I make mistakes every single day. Hopefully they're not big. I'm also looking for people who are presentable, you know, who have an ability to learn. I don't believe that you have to go to university and that you have to get a degree. I think if you're fortunate enough to, that's a great learning opportunity, and it provides you with a different perspective. But I've worked with a lot of good people who don't have degrees coming out of, you know, top-class universities. And those people sometimes have a better understanding of life and are more streetwise and are able to get a job done better than someone with a lot of theory.
So you would advise against doing an MBA?
No, I didn't say that. What I said was, if you're fortunate enough to be able to go through an MBA, you need to make sure that MBA is beneficial to what you're trying to achieve. You know, when I did my MBA, I saw people who were getting that MBA because they needed it within the organization to progress, and they generally weren't benefiting from it because for them it was bread and butter. But I saw other people who, for example, doctors and lawyers, who wanted a better business understanding, and by doing that MBA, they were able to broaden their scope and have a better understanding of a cash flow statement, which maybe they wouldn't have had.
Right. So, what you look for are people who are realistic, who are interested in the business, who basically want to learn. You're not really so concerned with the educational background, although it definitely helps, but you're more interested in the character and the personality traits. What are any of the other traits that you look for?
I always look, to understand what a person's about. So is there more to the person? What do they do outside of the office? You know, because I cannot work with people whose sole mission in life is to work. I think work alone makes that individual an extremely boring person. I'm looking for people who have a sense of adventure, who are able to relate to interests outside of the organization. And those interests don't have to be the same as mine, because it gives them a broader perspective on life. And I think having a broader perspective on life puts you in a far better position within the office environment.
So getting that balance, that work-life balance, is really critical.
It is
for you.
Even being a senior person within an organization, you need to remember that no one in the organization is ever going to thank you for missing your child's school play, you know, to attend a meeting. And that only happens once, when your child's got the lead in a school play. It's very, very important that you don't forgo those opportunities, because they won't come around again. You know, that business meeting will come around again. It will. There will be occasions when you have to miss things. That's a function of life. But the work-life balance is critical. And it's important for the relationship of your family, for your health and well-being.
So that's kind of what, you know, the things that you look for. What's your take on the automotive market now? I mean, is it really going to continue to grow where it is, or is it becoming more competitive? Will we see prices continue to drift upwards, or will kind of the economic trends we're seeing now cascade perhaps into the pricing? What are some of the, or are there any trends maybe that you find interesting out there that maybe we should know about?
I think the industry's changed significantly over the last 5 to 8 years, you know, since 2008, where we used to have very high levels of inventory. We were all about moving the metal. Things have changed now. It's a far more focused industry. It's an industry, I think, that's more responsible to the shareholders, the stakeholders of organizations, and more responsible to customers at the end of the day. Do I think there's going to be significant change in the motor industry over the coming years? No, I don't. I think what we will see is the competitive products, the marketplace is full of competitive products and will continue to be so. There will be technological improvements, technological enhancements. Those dependent on the supply and demand and the economic situation can benefit the customer, or to the point you made earlier, there can be a price increase, you know, for the customer. But at the end of the day...
The price is going up again.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. I said it's a function of supply and demand. I think the industry is stable. I don't believe we're going to see unprecedented levels of growth. I would like to think the Middle East, we have a very positive outlook on as an organization, and it's one of our key growth areas. So being based in the Middle East at this moment in time, I'm happy to say that the next 5 to 7 years, we are predicting growth.
And so you're not seeing predicting a big change from this electric car trend or this hybrid trend?
I think there will be evolution. I don't believe there's going to be revolution in the motor industry. Technology will enhance, technology will improve. We will start to move towards electric cars. Well, we are already, globally, cars that are starting to self-drive, et cetera, but it's not going to change overnight.
I don't want a self-driving car.
Exactly.
It's just weird. I think all this technology stuff is annoying. Like, I have this parking assist. Like, I'm in the middle of a conference call. I'm talking to someone, and he's like, yeah, Shane, you know, the price for the car. And then beep, 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 beep. It's like, people can park without this beeping sound. It's the most annoying thing. They're putting all these gadgets in the car, and it's just driving people up the wall.
Yeah, I think it's about getting the balance right. You know, what becomes a driving aid? What is legally required in some markets? Some markets, you have to have cameras on your cars. You know, Japan is an example of that.
You have to have
a camera on your car so that you can see.
Traction assist is annoying as well. I mean, at least you can turn it off. But, some of these things are, there's a couple brands out there where they're just, they're giving you kind of, it's less trinkets and more car. And I think there's a certain group of people out there who don't want all these bells and whistles. I don't know. We're probably a very minority piece.
No. Most manufacturers, give customers the ability to down-spec a car if they want. So in other words,
you can take the parking assist off?
You can.
I'm going to do that. I swear, right after this. As soon as we finish.
Should spend less time on the phone while you're driving.
Hey, it's hands-free. I'm legal. It's hands-free. But and now in Dubai, the business is picking up, and we have so many traffic jams. We're all spending a lot more time.
Yeah.
Is there any final words as we close here? Any final words of advice for anyone out there?
Yeah, I think as you grow your career, you have to be realistic in terms of what you're able to achieve. You've got to be brave. You have to take risks, but take sensible risks. Don't be scared to make mistakes. Get out there, make that mistake, but don't make it twice, and learn from your mistake, and then start to network with people. Networking's key. Have that drive and make sure you get the balance right in terms of your personal life and your working life.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for coming out. Hopefully we can have you out again sometime soon.
Great.
And we wish you luck. Not that you need it with brands like Jaguar and Land Rover. I think they're two of the favorite brands out here in the Middle East.
Thanks, Shane.
You just see them all over. You have to have, I think it's one of the signature vehicles of the region, right? You need to have your Range Rover on Vogue. Okay, thanks, Bruce. That's the story of Bruce Robertson. He's managing director for Jaguar Land Rover Middle East North Africa. And prior to him, we had Craig Moore on, who was the founder and chief executive officer of Beehive and also the founder of Butterfly. He talked about starting a .com business from scratch, which he's done now on his second time around. If you missed any of these stories, you can catch them on our website on dubaii1038.com/iOnCareers and listen to the podcasts. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, hoping the rest of your life is the best of your life.